You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Kurt and Andrew.
Hey, Bob.
Bob.
How are you guys doing?
Sublime.
I'm doing really good.
Did you say sublime?
That's that was unexpected, Kurt.
Top that, Andrew.
Yeah, well, I can't top that. I was actually going to say something much weirder than sublime, which is that I have a stomachache, so I'm not doing sublime, but I think I'll power through. We'll see.
Sublimely, Andrew. Sublimely.
Yeah.
You're not doing sublimely.
I'm doing sublimely, despite
unless,
the stomachache.
Unless sublime is a drug that you're on for the stomach thing, in which case you're doing sublime. Okay. Let me introduce... I'm Robert Wright, editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. It's also kind of a crossover because you guys are going to run it on the Right Now podcast feed, which that's the podcast of the American Conservative, where you both are. Kurt,
Tech
you
right
are executive
now.
Director. What's mm-hmm. that?
It's Tech Right Now. Yeah, the weekly podcast.
Oh, it's called Tech Right Now?
It is, that's actually. Right.
Okay, well, see, I was looking at the icon. I was going by the icon on my feed, but...
There allegedly through lore, I should probably talk about this on air, but there was a copyright dispute with...
Oh, right is that now. Right? I didn't know that.
Oh, there was already Right Now?
I don't think it's and really you, active. I think we would have made better use of it, but let's not get into...
No, I think it's important to air all controversies on the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And we've taken care of that one. So anyway, you're executive director at TAC, at the American Conservatives, which is... Very much like being editor-in-chief, I assume.
Correct.
And Andrew, you are senior editor.
That's right.
You look so young for a senior editor.
And there's a managing editor, Jude Russo. We got a features editor, Spencer Neal. Hmm. I'm the senior
Big
editor.
Big organization.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, as I said, this is going to be on both podcast feeds. And the truth is that TAC and Non-Zero have a certain amount in common in kind of foreign policy worldview, but there isn't complete overlap. And maybe we'll find out like where the borders are, because we're going to assess Donald Trump's foreign policy in the course of this and may find that we disagree on some things and are going to try to bring people up to speed on recent developments in various realms. So there's the Iran nuclear talks, there's the Ukraine war, there's China. /AI. We want to cover all that. What do you guys want to start with? The most recent, I guess, story was about Iran. Iran turned down the latest offer on the deal. Is that right?
The supreme leader seems to have turned it down. I mean, not to splice it.
I think he speaks for Iran, as I understand it.
Yeah, but my understanding, so this has been built like the Wall Street Journal, the headline on the piece about this is Iran rejects U.S. proposal, because the Trump administration had delivered the first formal written proposal to Iran on Saturday. And then there was some mixed reporting about what exactly it entailed, but it seems like it allows Iran to continue enriching uranium to low levels for a to-be-determined period, and that interim arrangement is supposed to lead to some final deal where Iran doesn't enrich uranium on its own territory, but maybe does so in a consortium with Arab states on an island in the Persian Gulf. It's a little complicated. The details are a little unclear. And the Ayatollah gave a speech basically rejecting the idea that Iran can be told to stop enriching uranium because they have a right to do so under the NPT. But, you know, obviously I don't speak Farsi, but I've heard some people who do speak Farsi saying that Khamenei is really good at giving these kind of florid speeches where he seems to be really emphatically rejecting some, you know, U.S. overtures and taking a hard line. But if you actually read it closely, you know, he's not really changing anything. He's still letting his team negotiate with the U.S. Hmm. I think there's reason to be concerned because, you know, this is a genuine red line for Iran. But I don't think they've quite just rejected the proposal yet. But there might still be room to work on this.
Yeah, I mean, not to pile on, but I do think, you know, there's only so much, you know, we really understand about this country, and I think it's not important to overstate it. But again, so far as we believe any of the sort of generally accepted reports, the supreme leader himself had to be convinced to even allow these negotiations, and he has been sort of counter-signaling them for some time. So, I mean, I don't think we should rule out the possibility that, you know, they come to some sort of interim framework or they come to some, you know, something less formal than what the JCPOA ever was, obviously very different. And then, like, you know, the guy just throws shade on this thing forever, but like he doesn't, you know, use the full power of the state to, you know, execute his foreign minister or prevent him from doing this. Like, I think it's unlikely that we're ever going to see like full throated endorsement of any framework from him and his team. And there's all these sort of obviously like internal reasons. Politics. He plausibly wants his son to succeed him. Hard to say which way that cuts vis-a-vis this. I just don't think we're ever going to see full unison between, you know, Pezeshki and Arashi and Khamenei, at least for the tea leaves. And I think, again, the Wall Street Journal, and I know the editorial board is separate from the reporting, although hasn't been, I think, entirely since October 7th. The Wall Street Journal generally emphasizes the most boilerplate hawk line on it. And Supreme Leader, not even interested in Trump's deal, is obviously the clean Murdoch wing headline they want.
So this is a little bit of a digression, but I'm curious. Are you saying the straight news reporting in the Wall Street Journal has moved to the right since October 7th, or the editorial board finally got sick of the Gaza war, which would surprise me? But.
Look, I be very careful. I think there was one particular report. I think in general, the Wall Street Journal reporting is very separate from the opinion board. And then there has been significant media reporting over the years about the level of some of the reporters on the team don't like the editorial board, et cetera, et cetera. This is well-worn territory. It wasn't reported by TAC. I think it was reported by the Times years ago. But the most relevant piece of reporting in general, I would say, in the last 2 years was the report that happened right after October 7th that basically alleged that Iran ordered the attack hook, line, and sinker. Oh. There was meetings, I believe the report said, with Hezbollah in Beirut. Like, this has never been retracted or apologized for or corroborated by any other reporting. And so all I am saying is, in general, I think certain headlines, my speculation, are often perhaps simplification that feeds into the hawk narrative. And then additionally, like what the, even if the newsroom is like, you know, pure straight reporting, the focus is very MIC, neocon-y. Like, you just go to the homepage like yesterday, and it's like, oh, the U.S. is diverting all of this military equipment from Ukraine back to the United States, which is like, you know, for our perspective, comical, because like we should be using U.S. military equipment for U.S. military purposes. But yeah, long point. Sorry.
That's okay. But as long as we're on a media critique digression, that's related to the Gaza war. There was a piece about, I don't know, 8 months ago or something, and I'm almost sure it was in the Wall Street Journal, and it had what I thought was the lead buried. They had intercepted some communications between the first Sinwar to get killed, you know, the head of the whole operation, and some of his colleagues. I guess Israel had intercepted them. Anyway, the journal got a hold of them, and down in the piece, it had Sinwar saying, yeah, things got out of control on October 7th. There weren't, you know, it wasn't supposed to be all that carnage. I don't mean, you know, I'm sure it didn't wind up coming as a shock to him that civilians had died or even that right. They had gone through towns trying to do basically ethnic cleansing in these Israeli villages. But I thought that was the lead. I thought that was an important thing. And they led with something that was not surprising at all and was unflattering.
What outlet was this, the journal or somebody else?
I'm almost sure it was the journal. And
I remember this because we covered it in Non-Zero. You know, I used to work at the Non-Zero newsletter.
That's right. And by the way, if people were wondering why I was correcting Andrew's grammar, that was kind of a jokey reference to the fact that Andrew used to work for me at Non-Zero.
Got it.
So I came out probably looking like a jerk, but it was an inside joke.
No, I mean, look, I mean, I think there's like, I subscribe to it. I think everybody reads it. Like, it's really important stuff. I just think the only allegation is that the sort of, I mean, every publication has a tone. And like, I think their tone is just writ large skeptical of the White House's negotiations with both the Iranians and the Russians.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Another example, the editorial board published this piece on Trump pausing, or for some reason, the press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, directed executive agencies, including, I think, the State Department, the Treasury Department, some others, to halt all new sanctions activity on Iran. And this was, you know, extremely, you know, I think the editorial board even may have been the first Wall Street Journal part to like report it, because that's usually what's linked to when people say that they reported this. And it was definitely to their dismay that they were talking about it. I mean, they're all in on maximum pressure. It definitely is like the most hawkish, like mainstream outlet on this specific issue. And I agree with you, Kurt, like the headlines are doing a lot of the work here, because I saw that headline on Twitter and I thought, oh no, you know, they rejected this proposal. I thought this was actually a pathway to agreement. Yeah.
I mean, very famously, writers don't have rights to the headlines, and like that goes for us as well. But like, people are just not reading stuff. Too much is happening. Whatever, smartphones are destroying our brains, whatever you think. But like, I mean, we read the articles, but a lot of people aren't. And like that is just, it's not malpractice, but it is not the full story. And then again, interesting nuggets that like perhaps don't meet like a certain line don't make it into the headline. So like stuff like, you know, breakdown between Hamas commanders and militants or terrorists. And like, you know, the militant commanders wanted less carnage, allegedly. Like, that's not going to be in a headline in the Wall Street Journal, confident. And then additionally, there has been other reporting. I don't know if it was in the WSJ and enough crapping on these guys. But like there has been other reportings that like there was a, you know, serious break between the political leadership in Doha and the military wing in Gaza. And it's not entirely clear that, you know, the diplomatic wing knew that the attack was going to occur. That's why the attack was successful. They weren't transmitting this stuff over email or phone calls. You know, they were doing it, you know, sort of house to house. And then additionally, you know, that confounds the narrative that there is like nobody workable with in Hamas whatsoever. And like, that's just obviously belied by the facts. Like, you know, Republican administration officials like Witkoff and Buller have basically said, and this is why Buller was kind of yanked from TV. They've said that like, you know, we met with Hamas and like, they were fine, and like not fine, but like they were, you know, they were workable with ending this war.
Is he the one who said they didn't have horns growing out of their heads?
That, and then, you know,
big mistake. Big mistake to say that
the Hamas leadership doesn't have horns. He's not a veteran, it seems, of DC policy, war, all of the, you know, the neocon stuff. Like, I think the three of us are, and like you know, Jake Tapper, who I think is, you know, a fairly straight journalist, but I think he leans neocon-y, in my opinion, like lost his mind on it. And then like the White House, which is curious about this stuff, but is not a uniform line on it, i.e. as negotiations with Iran, then, you know, pulls him from television. So,
okay. Now, I may have been a victim of that WSJ headline saying that Iran had turned the deal down. Maybe I took the headline.
The Supreme Leader complained about it and is not enormously sold on the purpose of these negotiations, it is clear to say, but it is not clear that the offer was rejected by the Iranian state in any meaningful way, or that or negotiations are leaving or ending, or that he will ever fully embrace any deal, in my opinion.
Yeah. I think the thing to take from statements, not only from Khamenei, but from the foreign minister and some other Iranian leaders and negotiators, is they're very serious about enrichment. Like, they do not want to give up their right to enrich uranium to low levels on Iranian territory. And, you know, in the past, you know, they're willing to go to 3.67. It wouldn't be surprising if they wanted that. They might see that that's already a concession, because there are legitimate things you can do at like 20% enrichment, as far as, I don't know exactly, but it has to do with medical isotopes, medical research. Mm-hmm. They're not even asking for that. I don't think they're going to agree to ever cease enrichment, even at some point in the future. I suspect that the Trump administration, you know, because Trump came out last week and on Truth Social after reports broke, principally by Axios, that the proposal that they sent Tehran allowed them to continue enriching uranium for a short time. Trump came out on Truth Social and said Iran cannot enrich uranium under any proposal. It was something like that. I believe that you know, he was referring to the ultimate deal rather than the interim arrangement. It was kind of like an evasive truth rather than a lie, because, you know, there's a lot of pressure every time there's any kind of signal from the White House that they're willing to let Iran continue enriching uranium. You get all, you know, the Mark Dubovitzes of the world really come hard at the administration. So they're trying to avoid that, but it's just confusing the Iranians, right? Because the Iranians are hearing this and say, they're not going to let us enrich uranium. That's a red line. Like, we're not going to put up with that.
It's not clear, though, in my view, I'm a little bit more bullish than what we just described, though. It's not entirely clear that they haven't ruled out this consortium thing, this thing with the Gulf states. And then, like, Trump, it might be a term of art, but it's literally true in this scenario, which is that they have achieved zero Iranian-only enrichment.
Yeah. But they want that consortium to be on their territory. I think they would be fine with
right,
that.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, wasn't Iran the first one to propose some sort of consortium arrangement? But mm-hmm. they had in mind that there would always be enrichment on their soil, and that's the current disagreement?
I don't think that originated from Iran, to my information. None of us have a monopoly on information, mm-hmm. but okay. my understanding was the consortium thing had been floated like months ago, very, very deep in the press somewhere. And then all of a sudden, like I had heard a week or two ago, like, boom, this is very real and it's very live in the negotiations.
Okay. I think it does come mediator. Down to
whether
it followed Trump's bear hug, not Netanyahu bear hug. It followed Trump's very clear alliance with the Gulf in his Middle East trip. That's when it came on, like Trump is.
That's when I saw it.
Yeah, Trump is good with Saudi. Trump is good with the Emiratis. Trump is good with Qatar. Trump is not 100% good with Israel. And Trump probably prefers the Gulf to Israel at this current point, or at least the leaderships of these countries. And then accordingly, Iran and all involved like worked even more to a rapprochement than they even have in the last couple of years.
So it sounds like the whole thing may be, do we or do we not let Iran enduringly enrich uranium to some level, far from weapons grade, on their own soil? Not just for 1 year, not just for 2 years, but throughout the deal, right?
That's some discussion of an island somewhere. So I don't want to just keep getting drilled down in details, but like...
Right, but I mean, I don't think Iran's going to buy an island that's not part of Iran.
They haven't ruled it out.
Well, tell me this, Kurt. I listened today to the podcast conversation you had with Kelly Vlahos on her podcast. It's tripping
the beltway. They don't trip the beltway or something. Tripping the beltway.
Trip the beltway. Fantastic.
Kelly's got that hippie.
She explained it to me on my podcast when I had her on. It's a reference to dancing, apparently. Anyway, at that point, you and she, I don't know when that was taped, were complimenting Trump on how much he has stood up to Israel compared with other presidents. I'm not so persuaded that he's actually done much that took courage. But in any event, would you say that if Trump isn't willing to come around to just some level of enrichment on Iranian soil for the duration of the deal, if that's what it takes to get a deal, if he's not willing to do that, would you still say he's standing up to Israel enough? Because it seems to me like a pretty trivial concession, to be honest, as a practical matter. Because the monitoring last time around was extremely intrusive and effective, and I think it can be set up that way again.
I think there's a difference between the technical and the political. So, my own view, and I'm not the president or in the administration, like my own view is like I agree with you, but politically, the hawks have set zero enrichment as this, red line. And Trump, for whatever reason, and we can speculate on it, I think it's possible that he's just throwing them a bone, has reiterated in his own personal statements. So it is a relevant political, it's a relevant point, even if it's not like technically a relevant point.
But these hawks are an extension of Israel and the Israel lobby, right? I mean, you mentioned Mark Dubowitz, Andrew. No doubt that he fits that description. And so this is what it would mean to be courageous with respect to Israel is to defy people like him who are demanding that you do whatever.
But I would prefer it just work. So my own view is if they were able to achieve something, again, I'm open to more enrichment than Trump's messaging has supplied. But as of, the world as it is, if they were able to achieve an energy consortium, then claim that they had zero Iranian only enrichment, and the Iranians signed that deal, and Trump said, I did what the hawks said, and they're still acting in bad faith and want a war, that strikes me as the most politically optimal solution as of June 5th.
That would be fine with me. But I mean, if Iran won't go that far.
Agreed. Well, then we'll have to see what they do. I mean, because, yeah. I mean, as Andrew's referenced, there's been other reporting that, like, they're considering some level of enrichment. And, like, mm-hmm. again, I think that's fine. I think that's the fine of, for the editorial line of our magazine. But, like, you know, I just want a deal, a good mm-hmm. deal. And so, like, I'm less bogged down on it.
And are you still feeling as complimentary toward Trump? Again, I don't know when you recorded this, but like yesterday, the U.S. vetoed the U.N. Security Council resolution that 14 of the 15 members supported that called for, it wasn't even a particularly biased, I mean, it called for both the end of the ceasefire and the release of all the hostages. And first of all, when you think about it, in truth, Netanyahu would love that. Actually, if he just had to quit, stop the war for a few days and they'd release all the hostages, then he could just renege on a deal and go back with the war. Or for that matter, if they pass that resolution, he could just say, okay, we'll stop for 2 days. And if they don't release all the hostages, we'll be back at it. And we complied with the resolution and they didn't. So it doesn't seem to me like it was a big ask to support that resolution, but Trump was not willing to do it.
Agreed. I mean, look, I mean, the administration is not invested in the UN, I think it's clear to say. I mean, like, they keep trying to put, Turtle Bay is becoming the sort of neocon concession prize, right? Stefanik, now Waltz, presuming he gets in, which I think you can't presume, you know, and, you know, it's basically a fundraising vehicle for neocons to complain about, you know, all of Israel's enemies and grandstand and not do that much. Now, ideally, think, you know, I'm net pro the UN. I have my frustrations with it, but I think the US should use it. This is just not a prerogative of this administration. As to my level of how complimentary I've been of Trump, like, I mean, I, not to quote Joe Biden, don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative. So, like, you know, I think this administration has been better than the previous one so far. And I think Trump is better than almost all of his opponents in the Republican Party. So, like, those are the major actors on the American scene, and that's my view.
Yeah, I mean, if you imagine Phil Gordon being national security advisor for Kamala Harris, not that I was enthusiastic about right. the Harris concept, I think he would be at least as good, and I think they would be putting more pressure on Bibi to end the Gaza war now, I think, than Trump is.
I don't know. I mean, like, the Phil Gordon thing is like, look, I'm sure he's a nice guy. Like, you know, he says some good stuff on X. Like, it is like some national security advisor who works for her as VP. The extent of the relationship is extremely unclear versus what she was saying as a candidate versus what she did to close her campaign, campaigning with Liz mm-hmm. Cheney in Wisconsin, like putting aside the hilarious tactics of that aside, they believe this stuff. What the Democratic establishment has been doing in the early days of the Republican administration, Alyssa Slotkin, one of the most neoconservative members of Congress, being the, you know, the State of the Union where they address the Congress rebuttal. And then additionally, the Democratic leaders' clear willingness to weaponize the Iran issue to call Trump a coward, right? Like they are using the taco thing on Iran as well as tariffs, like effectively daring him to bomb the Iranians. So like, I think Harris has not shown in public life any individual initiative from the Democratic establishment. So, like,
I guess what I mean is, how could our Gaza policy be worse and less productive than it is under Trump? What would that be like? How could we do less than zero to try to end the war?
Most of the carnage occurred under the Democrats. So, like, I mean, we have that.
Well, right. But I mean, now, how could it be worse than Trump's policy? What else could he do to make his Gaza policy even less effectual, if you assume he would like to end the war? What could he do that would be even worse?
We're all reporting they are trying to drive for the Israelis to end the war in some pretty tough measures. I mean, there's been other, I mean, that Wyckoff is potentially circulating these photos of the children to Trump, that they are really playing hardball in a way that the Democrats never did. I mean, like, I don't think he's perfect, but I prefer, like, the president who says these things versus, like, the State Department spokesman who openly says one thing in power and then on a liberal podcast says the opposite. Like, that's what the Democrats are right now.
Yeah, I would not defend anything about Biden's policy toward Israel at all, and I didn't at the time, and I was very critical. And I'm happy if there are people within the White House trying to convince Trump to do something. My point is he hasn't done anything, right? I mean, we have leverage. We could end the war.
Sure.
We have the leverage. We could shut off the weapons. And if you had sufficient political courage and were president, which obviously Biden didn't have, and I don't think Kamala Harris would have had, you could do that. But I don't see how you could do less than Trump is doing.
Can I?
I guess I don't really understand the question. I mean, like, I think he's doing.
Well, I mean, you're very complimentary of how tough he's being on Israel. And Andrew, before this, I just want to say the Gaza war, there's a lot of bad shit in the world. The Ukraine war is bad. But the Gaza war is the most, to me, the most clearly bad for American interests. Last week, somebody threw a Molotov cocktails at Jewish Americans. Before that, two people were killed in Washington. Obviously, the blame for those acts lies with the people who did them. However, if the Gaza war had ended a year ago or even a month ago, those things would be less likely to happen. In lots of ways, the Gaza war is fraying the American social fabric. It's really bad for us. Biden didn't do a damn thing. Harris probably wouldn't have. And Trump isn't. That's all I'm saying. I don't understand why you're praising his policy toward Israel.
It is not what I would do hook, line, and sinker. But I think it is preferable to what Biden is doing. I think it is preferable to, I think, any reasonable forecast of what a Harris administration would have done. I understand Mr. Gordon has, like, is one official. Like, it is very possible that Liz Cheney could have been the national security advisor or the secretary of defense. That is not fan fiction. That could have happened. So this is just merely my preferred president of the three most likely presidents of 2024, Harris, Biden, and Trump. From that, I think behind the scenes, it is fairly extraordinary that Trump is pushing Netanyahu so openly and viscerally when, contra Biden, Trump probably has accepted more, you know, neoconservative hawk financing for his political career or his presidential career in recent years than Biden ever did. So they have more leverage on him and he's just ignoring it. And I think it is fairly extraordinary. I do think they should pull the weapons, but I think they should be praised for what they have done so far, which I think is more than nothing.
Well, Andrew, you wanted to say something. After you say it, I'm going to ask Kurt what Trump has done with respect to Israel that's impressive. But Andrew, you were going to say something?
Well, I just wanted to add, I mean, obviously there are structural problems here, namely the Israel lobby has enormous influence on the federal government. So there's a bipartisan issue here. I also think another thing worth considering or just kind of interesting to note is I believe that Trump, you know, when he invited Bibi to the White House early in the administration, I think it was in February, I believe it was that Netanyahu was the first foreign leader to come to the Oval Office. I wrote at the time, it wasn't the main thing that I was writing in this article, but I suggested that Trump was trying to establish some sort of tacit quid pro quo where he lets Netanyahu kind of do what he wants on Gaza. And in exchange, Netanyahu doesn't interfere with what Trump wanted to do on Iran, because he used the occasion of Netanyahu's visit to make some pronouncements on Iran that Trita Parsi of the Quincy Institute found interesting, for example. He basically said, you know, we have this maximum pressure campaign on Iran, but I don't want to use it fully. And I don't even think everyone in Iran and their leadership actually even wants to have a nuclear weapon. And then during this Q&A, when Netanyahu was saying they're very weak right now, now is the time to strike, or some reporter suggested that and Bibi agreed with it, Trump intervened and said, no, they're very strong right now. And that was kind of his way of saying, no, we're not going to strike them. And then, you know, during Netanyahu's second visit, which the pretense was that was to talk about tariffs. You know, Trump announced during his kind of Oval Office meeting with Netanyahu that they were starting direct negotiations with the Iranians like that weekend. And the actual reason Netanyahu visited was to kind of press the administration on Iran because they were opposed to diplomacy. So I think if I was in the Trump administration, and if indeed I am right that he tried to establish this quid pro quo, I would be thinking to myself, well, they're not honoring it. They are actively interfering in our Iran diplomacy. There's all these indications that they're thinking about striking Iran just to screw up the deal. The purpose of that, by the way, would be to kind of, you know, invite this Iranian retaliation that America would be obligated to defend against, because otherwise, you know, this nuclear armed state is just, you know, being bombarded by missiles. So if I was in the administration, I would say, okay, screw this. We need to cut them off, not only for our sake, for the reasons you mentioned, Bob, but also for Israel's sake. Like, this is not good for their interests. They are facing total diplomatic isolation. The Europeans are turning sharply against them. Even Americans, especially young people, are turning against Israel. So I don't think that Trump's been good on Gaza. He even kind of gave the green light to end the ceasefire, you know. You know, at this point, I don't think he should give them cover anymore at the UN or in any other way.
Yeah, no, it's interesting what Kurt said, though, that because they don't care about the UN, it makes sense for them to give that as a consolation prize to the neocon contingent. That kind of makes sense to me as a political matter. Kurt, did you want to say something in response to my question about what? So what has Trump? I mean, the things they say is, well, he stopped the bombing of the Houthis. Well, he started the bombing. I mean, that you know, look, the Houthis felt no constraints about attacking Israel or Israeli ships before he started the bombing, during the bombing, or after it. So stopping it.
Yeah, I can see the point that there hasn't been the result that would be desirable. But yeah. I think the efforts and the political capital and the sort of policy daring that has been going on behind the scene does deserve some level of commendation, which is that they are willing to break with the Israeli government and they are willing to pressure the Israeli government. And that has been widely reported. And it is a point of extreme anxiety and frustration. Like, just ask the Israelis. Let's just read what the extreme hawk press says about Trump now. I think that is evidence that they are doing more than nothing.
Yeah. Well, if he gets a nuclear deal with Iran, that'll definitely be to his credit. But Gaza is such a disaster. I mean, obviously, the Gazans.
We haven't even mentioned the Gaza Lago thing, which, like, I mean, you know, I think that's bad. I also think it's unworkable.
I hadn't heard that term. You mean Trump's the Riviera on Gaza or whatever, Gaza on the Riviera? The five-star hotel as the logical culmination of ethnic cleansing being a five-star hotel.
Well, I alluded to it earlier. That's what I mean when he gave them the green light. I don't think that was his intention. I'm not sure he thought about all the implications of what he was saying.
I mean, look, he obviously has hawkish, very pro-Netanyahu contingents in his very pro-Israeli hardline contingents within his own family. Like, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, this is an open secret. This is publicly known. And
you mean Jared?
Sure, of course. Yeah. But like the nature, but I mean, the nature of their relationship right now is not open, not well understood. Like, Jared's not back. Why mm-hmm. isn't he back? How often does he talk? How influential is he? Not well reported. And so, you know, the initial Gaza redevelopment plan was pitched and Netanyahu's first visit to Washington and Trump too. And again, we don't know, but it's entirely possible. It's like one of these things was workshopped. Someone in the administration has it. And he said it to get rid of Netanyahu, you know, just get rid of him. You know, like just throw him something because, like, so far, again, this magazine, I will condemn it if that ever even gets close to action. But we haven't heard anything about action. There's reports in NBC or whatever about, you know, let's move these people to Libya. How? Israeli boats? What Israeli Navy? Okay. American boats? I mean, there's not mass deportations in the United States. We're going to do mass deportations in Gaza. Like, until it's an actual thing, I think it's hard to, like, spend too much time analyzing.
Yeah, although, I mean, the ethnic cleansing, I would say the ethnic cleansing is underway. They have made life completely miserable and dangerous and often fatal to the people living there. That's step one.
And this has nothing to do with U.S. national interest, and I think it's bad, but I also think it's bipartisan.
Oh, yeah, totally. And I would say the same thing about the West Bank. You know, they just okayed what? A couple of dozen settlements? Whole settlements. This is big, and this happened within the last week. And I think you can now say, given the settler violence and the growth in the number of settlements, that, you know, ethnic cleansing is underway in Gaza, in the West Bank as well. I mean, there have been bursts of it manifestly in the past, but it's starting to look like a larger scale thing.
It kind of seems like the world is finally arriving at the position that we need a two-state solution, like at the moment when that has become impossible to achieve. And there's going to be no two-state solution here.
I'm more open that it's possible, but you have the more voguish opinion on the real.
I hope you're right.
you probably saw that Europe is going to recognize the state of Palestine. Macron is pushing for them to. They might not. I think the UK is a little wary because the UK was also going to be involved in this potentially. But yeah, it's
France
like well,
has this conference that they're trying to do. And I think in a few weeks, Macron might even be there in New York. And so, agreed. I mean, I don't think it's impossible. I mean, there has been some talks about like Hamas PA merger, especially if like the Hamas leadership is so wiped out and Abbas dies. Like there has been, I don't think it's impossible. And I know a lot of people do, but I don't think it's impossible because they're not going anywhere. And like Israel is going to have to kill them all. Or like somebody else is going to have to move them for them. So like, you know, given the three options, again, most likely, I still think a negotiated settlement could.
We would need an Israeli government that was willing to reduce settlements and take them back rather than a settler government that was trying to expand them.
From the perspective of the U.S., Netanyahu is the most unpredictable and least desirable prime minister. I mean, if they replaced him, I mean, other than I would say like the Ben-Gavirs or the Smotriches, you know, like, but I think that's very possible in Israel's future, the way it's going. But like, if you replaced it today with like Naftali Bennett, who I don't think has any, you know, loss towards the Palestinians and might not have conducted the war very differently, it's at least not somebody who is going to reinvade because he is going to give testimony that morning, which is why, I mean, per some reporting, Israel broke the ceasefire in March.
Mm-hmm.
It is just...
I think it was 2010 or something. I visited the West Bank for a week with actually a lot of Matt Duss organized it. Michelle Goldberg was there. A lot of people there. I came back and I got on a plane and I found myself sitting next to John Kerry. And I think this was before he was Secretary of State. I think he was
Senate Chairman.
I kind of conspicuously pulled out. It was right in the envelope of my backpack. This map of the West Bank, and he said, "Oh, have you?" He looked over and said, "Oh, have you figured out a solution?" And I said, "Actually, I was just there, and I've decided it's too late for a two-state solution." And shortly thereafter, he lost interest in the conversation. But that was my view even then. And
how long ago was
the way, this wasn't first class. There was no first class. If you're asking how I could wind up in the same milieu as John Kerry, there was no gradation of status on this plane.
2010.
What's that?
Andrew's asking when this was 2010. You said, right?
I'm pretty sure it was 2010. Could have been. Yeah. It must've been.
Yeah, he became sex state in 13. He was.
Yeah.
Chairman of the foreign relations. Cause that was the real, like, wilderness years for him, actually, right? Because, like, he had Obama took over the Democratic Party. He wasn't in the administration in the first term. And he's marooned in the Senate. Biden, his friend, had become vice president. So,
yeah.
Interesting time.
So, anyway, I'm more pessimistic about a two-state solution than either of you, if Andrew thinks it only recently became practical, you know, as a practical matter, impossible. But, God, I'd love to believe it can happen. Mm-hmm. What should we, I'm very curious about the China thing, but we could save that for later. I mean, let me ask you quickly, there seems to be a pretty strong bipartisan consensus that China is this nearly implacable adversary. In any event, we're in for a Cold War-like relationship for a long time. You know, China hawkism is ascendant. I'm wondering if in your neck of conservatism, which is to say, first of all, if people don't know, your magazine was founded by Pat Buchanan. Buchanan was in some ways a kind of precursor of Trump, certainly in the sense of not favoring a lot of military intervention, thinking that you should be able to justify it only on grounds of strict national interest, not being enthusiastic about immigration, being more open to tariffs than other schools of, you know, conservative thought. So in many ways, you know, he's, I don't know if you guys identify with the phrase MAGA, but, the tradition of the magazine, a lot of overlap with what Trump professes to be about, at least. Yeah. So I'm wondering, I mean, I don't honestly know enough. I'm also wondering, do you guys ever, you know, I mean, Buchanan's still around, but I assume, you know, he's not hanging out with you much. And I'm wondering, first of all, if you ever find yourself, you know, like what would it be? WWPD? What would Pat do?
I wrote an article called "On Iran: What Would Pat Buchanan Do?" just a couple of months ago. So yeah, I do think that question.
He'd be pro deal. He'd be pro deal, right?
He was very in favor of Obama's deal. He called it the seminal achievement of Obama. That of Obama's administration in foreign policy. Mm-hmm.
And that did involve standing up to the lobby. That
he debated Hannity on it. Like, there's a hilarious clip somewhere.
Buchanan did.
Yeah, like he debated Hannity. Like, Hannity's like, do you think that we shouldn't have fought World War II? And like, Pat Buchanan's like, well, as a matter of fact, Sean, you might have my other book.
Yeah. But on China, WWPD, I mean, you know, he'd be okay with coherent tariffs. I got to think he, like everyone else's, thinks that Trump's aren't coherent collectively.
But, yeah, I speak for him. But I mean, I think he would be happy that they're doing tariffs as opposed to doing no tariffs.
But and what about engagement more broadly? I mean, I have my own views, but would he be a China hawk aside from the tariffs, I guess, is part of the question.
I think
would he go to war over Taiwan?
I don't know. I don't know. I think. I mean, if you read, like, I think it was like this sort of early Bush administration Barnburner book on a lot of these issues, where the right went wrong by him. I do remember him. There's a whole chapter on China and has like some Napoleon quote about how I think it's Napoleon, like how if you know China's a sleeping dragon or something, or maybe some apocryphal Napoleon quote. And like, but when it wakes, it will shake the world. So I think there has been always within whatever you want to call it, our neck of the woods, paleoconservatism, whatever, like a sense that the U.S. is fighting all these pointless wars for other countries that don't serve U.S. national interest, and that China is different. How different is, I think, debated. Andrew, do you have any disagreement?
Or? Well, I agree with you. And I'd point out, even though Pat Buchanan is associated with being strongly in favor of U.S. foreign policy restraint to the point where the magazine was founded basically to oppose the Iraq war. And, you know, they even were encouraging people to vote for the Democrats because they were so fed up with the Bush administration.
Pat didn't. Pat voted for Bush in 2004, basically out of party loyalty. Scott, who founded the magazine, co-founded the magazine, voted for Kerry. I think Tacky, who also founded, I don't remember. I think he voted third party. But there was, and we are currently and have been through a lot of our history, nonprofit. And so we don't endorse. We have done symposiums. And like I can regale you with like my memory of who voted for what, who's probably associated with the magazine over the last 20 years. There was definitely divided ranks in 2004.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I was just kind of highlighting that to point out, people might not realize that Pat Buchanan was actually a bit of a cold warrior. He's been around for a long time. Okay. He was like in the Nixon administration.
He was a speechwriter for Nixon, wasn't he?
Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, it makes sense to me that he was a cold warrior, even though that seems inconsistent with the perception of him as, you know, he's not a peacenik. It's not really as axiomatic.
Everybody was a cold warrior then. I mean, I remember that.
Period. Yeah.
I was young, but I remember it. Everybody
but some,
was
but some more than others. And people on the right, I mean, this is one reason all of these Trotskyists, you know, Trotskyites gravitated to the Republican Party because they hated Stalin. And then they started to think that the Republican Party, you know, was more bold in its opposition to the Soviet Union. And I think Pat Buchanan probably would have been, you know, on that end of the spectrum. Like he identified a real threat from the Soviet Union. And it's just once that collapsed, you know, he started talking about, well, let's not antagonize Russia. Let's have a stable security order. Let's only fight in our national interest, not just because we're the big Unipol and we can do whatever we want. I do think on China, I mean, China is something different than, you know, China hawkism, I think, is distinct from Iran hawkism and from Russia hawkism. It makes a little more sense. Sometimes people ask why realists like John Mearsheimer, you know, are there China hawks, but they're Iran doves. But to me, it makes sense. Like, according to realist theory, it makes sense that they would see things in that way. It's not really
an
inconsistency.
Well, it's a rival in a way that, you know, it's a superpower in a way that no other country aside from us is.
If I could just also, on the tariffs thing, because I do think it's important to talk about what a coherent tariff policy would look like. I think it makes sense. It's perfectly legitimate and even prudent to try to have economic policies, whether industrial policy or tariffs or trade agreements, that ensure that the U.S. makes critical supplies here at home. Like, that's a legitimate thing for a nation to worry about. I do think that these export controls on like microchips are kind of, they're inconsistent with that logic, right? Because we're preventing our companies from exporting critical technologies to China. The intention, I guess, is to slow down China's rise, but the effect is probably going to be that they become less dependent on our goods and there's less demand for our companies' critical technologies. So stuff like that, I do think there's room for improvement on these kinds of policies. But it makes sense to me to have a little bit of a flavor of China hawkism. Like, I think Iran hawkism is insane and Russia hawkism has been counterproductive historically. But I probably do have more concerns about China. I imagine Buchanan would as well.
I think China hawkins is on the verge of being counterproductive in much the way Russia hawkism was. I mean, I don't mean you don't need to draw the line somewhere. And, you know, they're both great powers. They're going to try to exert influence. They're going to struggle along the lines of disagreement and so on. But I worry about, and by the way, this is kind of relevant. I'm interested in what you guys have to say about views about AI. Mm-hmm. But the chip thing, Andrew, in no few circles, the rationale for that is more dramatic than let's slow China's rise. There is this idea that's been popularized that, you know, this is the death struggle. Whoever gets to artificial general intelligence or super intelligence first or whatever dominates the world. You would be surprised. Look, Dario Amode of Anthropic is going around saying that. Various other people are. It's a common belief. I'm not even saying it's crazy, but I am saying that the rhetoric surrounding AI is very dramatic in some realms. I mean, Ivanka Trump famously retweeted a tweet about this influential paper by this extremely young guy who I think doesn't understand geopolitics. It's called Situational Awareness. It's been very influential, and it takes this line. There's a lot of that being invoked rhetorically, at least, to justify the chip controls, which I think are already backfiring, and to justify a lot of other stuff. Kurt, did you have a take on this? I mean, I can drill down more specifically and ask you about AI in a more specific way, but...
You want to talk AI or China?
Talk about whichever you want to talk about first, and then I'll ask about the other, maybe.
I mean, I guess... Yeah. I mean, I guess the view on China would be... I myself have become probably less hawkish on it in the last 3 to 4 years. I historically say I was probably something of a China hawk, a dove on the other theaters, basically. And I think that's like coherent. Like, we should, if this is a real rival, the other ones are, what the heck are we doing? I would say, you know, it's pretty related to the economics, in my opinion. So, I mean, I'm 34, so I mean, the worst thing that happened macro in my lifetime was not 9/11, it was COVID. And, you know, that was a byproduct of effectively an era of, quote, free trade with China, in which, you know, the world shut down because of however Chinese society was configured after decades and decades and decades of that arrangement, had to shut down the world and, you know, wrecked a lot of people's lives. A lot of people have like not psychologically come back from it. That does strike me as, you know, not optimum and, you know, a system that should be questioned. So I would prefer if we are much less economically integrated with China, even if it is, quote, less efficient. And as towards, you know, any kind of military showdown, I'm not convinced it's inevitable. And I obviously don't think it's desirable. But I also think the status quo is kind of okay, which is U.S. maintains strategic ambiguity. I don't know what Xi Jinping will do. Everybody can do criminology on him all day. And I think Chinese criminology is pretty interesting. But until he makes a move, not really sure what there is to talk about.
So just to be clear, you're saying the degree of economic engagement with China made it more likely that the pandemic would wind up in America if it started there, or you're saying something else?
I think so. I mean, like we have encouraged a development model in that society in which they have rapidly developed and also strengthened the state. And obviously, whatever you think with the origin of China, of COVID was, you know, hygiene, bioweapon, intentionally released bioweapon. Like, I'm just kind of tired talking about COVID. I think everyone's just like pretending like it never happened. Regardless, it is a product. I mean, like, China does not exist today without the economic relationship that started in the 70s and went into turbo drive in the 90s.
Well, the one thing I think we can rule out is China intentionally releasing a bioweapon in China.
I'm not sure we know how COVID started, so I'm not sure we can rule out anything.
Well, that would be pretty irrational. But
why would it be?
You don't release bioweapons in your own country. You release them in other countries.
It goes to the world, and the Chinese have a strong record of caring about the humanitarian concerns of their own people. I mean, I don't really believe that, but I don't think we'd know what happened. That is the point, which is why they are a scary trade partner.
Well, we could have a long argument about this, but I am, well, first of all, we're reaching, nearing the end of the public portion of this. We're going to stick around and talk for a while in overtime, which is available to everyone who is a Non-Zero member, which is to say paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter. Easy to become one. You go to Non-Zero, sign up, click the link in the show notes. But before we do that, we should give you guys a chance to talk about your own stuff. First of all, your podcast, for people who aren't listening to this on your podcast, who already know this, presumably, is TAC Right Now. You're staying on the right side of the law with that by starting that with TAC. Good. But what else? Are there recent pieces? I mean, you guys have an actual physical magazine, right?
We went to print today. So thank you. The new issue will be out next week. And
that's cool.
It's on immigration. And well, that's the cover piece anyways. But it'll have a selection of other stuff. And it is cool.
It is. Why, when I was a boy, every magazine was physical. But also you have a very active website. People should check it out. Andrew, any self-promotion you want to do? You're not allowed to talk about your child. Lovely child.
Thank you.
Especially in the Non-Zero onesie. But any stuff you've done lately or any...
Well, yeah, I'll just talk about a couple of pieces I've written on the American Conservative website. And just to make clear to your listeners, Bob, that they probably find a lot that they agree with at the American Conservative. I mean, we've been talking about China. The last piece I edited that ran on our website was talking about how our efforts to make Taiwan a porcupine and give it all this, you know, military support and station U.S. troops there is actually provoking China. And we need to get into the mindset of actually trying to manage this relationship in a, you know, rational, you know, way that is respectful of China's interests, because we don't want to be antagonizing them. So we run pieces like that often. My latest piece is on Iran and uranium enrichment, some of the stuff I was talking about earlier. And as you said, Tech Right Now, I'm the host. We have a kind of rotating cast of people who come and talk to me. Sometimes we have guests from the outside, but it's usually staffers from the American Conservative. So people can give that a listen. And we have a YouTube channel as well, the American Conservative on YouTube.
So check all that out. And there is a lot of overlap in our worldviews. When you were at Non-Zero, Andrew, I don't think you disagreed with a lot of stuff. In retrospect, now that you've actually come out of the closet as something of a conservative, I realize there may have been some things I said about global governance that you weren't enthusiastic about.
Well, I mean, we're pretty simpatico when it comes to foreign policy. It's more like immigration, law and order, stuff like that, where I tend to part company with.
Yeah, I'm against law and order. It's true.
Well, I know Connor is a prison abolitionist. I don't know if he'd want.
But Connor is to my left.
Yeah.
Okay. So thanks everybody who stayed with us this far. Hope you will follow us into overtime. And that's where we're going to go.